the podcast that Spotify tried to ban. Ding, 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 ding. You get the idea. Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files podcast, the podcast that is happily international. We recognize that borders are largely arbitrary, made-up things. Unfortunately, so is currency. And I don't have any of either, actually. Anyway, I'm one of your hosts, John Bruford, joined by your other host, Fintan Costello. Fintan, hello.
Hello, John.
How are we?
Good.
How are your borders? Are you being invaded?
No.
It's a thing, apparently.
I'm the invader. I'm the foreigner living in a third country. I haven't even learned the language.
You sound like a British football manager. Interesting. I don't know if I ever told you this. I probably did because I've told you everything at least twice. But my brother was a keen, I don't know whether he still is, but he was a keen supporter of the Trump campaign in his first election. So what was that, 2016? And he was happily declaring to me that, yeah, it's the immigrants that are the problem. Now, at this point, my brother had lived in the US for 20 years and could see no irony in anything he was saying. But you know, God bless him. So what have you been up to, Fintan? Anything or nothing?
Just terrorizing the internet, really. Just doing
executive
my thing.
Executive stuff.
Executive stuff, yeah. Trying to make a dollar.
I hear you. I hear you. I'm in a similar boat. But I've not been up to it. I mean, I've not been up to anything except moving house.
Which is a big deal.
It's quite a big deal. So I'm now living in a disabled adapted property, which is quite exciting. And just figuring out how it works for my daughter, whether it works for my daughter. It's been occasionally hilarious. The occasional meltdown, and by her, but it's been an education. But I got to say, given that the property was provided by my local council, it's extraordinary that such things are possible, and I am deeply, deeply grateful. And will be paying my taxes in full, just like I do all the time. There are no tax evaders or avoiders on this podcast. Speaking of not avoiding or evading tax, Fintan.
Oh, Jesus Christ. It's like you hate our sponsors, John.
It seems a good time to bring them up because they are responsible suppliers of their wares in our industry space. And well, no I'd, doubt pay their tax.
I'd like to thank Optimove.
You should.
Optimove are the kings of positionless marketing. If you want to discover how operators are using Optimove, positionless marketing platform, to launch personalized CRM campaigns, dynamically change casino lobbies and bet slips, and create an engaging gamified experience, go to optimove.com. That's optimove.com.
I want to know all of that, so I'm going to go there.
I think you should.
Because I'm also aware that if you go there, and you mentioned that the Gambling Files sent you, there's a tasty incentive. I'm not just saying that because I was eating a sausage while you were reading that advert. Not a euphemism. So it's also a good time to mention our relatively new kids on the block, but much loved, because one of our other sponsors is GLI. In fact, you could say they're official testing lab sponsors.
Ooh.
Why not?
Well, we've talked about launching our own slot game, so makes sense.
We have. I can't wait until somebody does that for us. But today's episode is brought to you by Gaming Laboratories International. GLI is a world-class testing, inspections, and certification company committed to delivering the highest quality land-based lottery and iGaming testing and assessment services around the world. One of these days, I'm going to put an extra full stop in there somewhere. But in the meantime, GLI provides suppliers, operators, and regulators with expert guidance for navigating the future of gaming and ensuring gaming innovations meet regulatory standards with confidence in more than 710 jurisdictions. And Fintan, if you'd like more information, you can visit gaminglabs.com.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Why not? What have you got to lose? Huh?
Nothing. Nothing.
Exactly. I mean, if you were going to say my self-respect or my dignity, I'd point out that we've done 260 episodes. And that was left at the door a long time ago. So today's guest, I'm very... Oh, no, Fintan. Don't jump ahead. We missed out a sponsor. You've missed out a sponsor. Not only that, but they've got an event coming up in like 7 weeks.
Look, World Gaming, amazing events organizer, do the best, probably the best gambling events in the world. We're all still recovering from ICE, and I don't know about you, but I'm all ready for IGB London.
Are you going? You are going.
Yeah, I am going. And yeah, I'll probably be at the awards as well.
How was the awards?
IGB affiliate.
They're World Gaming Run Awards.
Yep.
Well, that's pretty exciting.
I presume it's them. I'm sure it's them.
Well,
yeah,
we're gonna,
yeah, it's IGB. Yeah, it's them.
we're gonna have somebody from World Gaming on in the very near future to talk about what's going on at IGB Live in London. But that's to be confirmed. I think it might be the episode after next, but I'm not sure.
Ooh, okay.
Because, you know, I'm a big picture guy, Fintan. You're a details guy. And mm-hmm. I've just thrown it out there and they've just said, yeah, all right. We haven't booked it or anything.
It's all right. They're busy. But,
They're busy. They're busy organizing world-class events. That's how good they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's their raison d'etre. Anyway, this week's guest, I'm a little bit excited about because I read an article by him and I thought, ooh, that's good. And so here we are. So I'd like to introduce new to the podcast, first time guest, who knows, possibly last time. It's hard to say, but let's see how the next few minutes go. We're joined by Matthew Lynn, a journalist who writes mostly for the Telegraph, Daily Telegraph in Britain, and the Washington Post, which is, you know, in Washington, D.C. Matthew, welcome.
Hi, good to be on, guys.
Thank you for joining us. Much appreciated. Now, as I explained to Fintan before I pressed record, I took the genius move of not forwarding him the article that I read before you came on, which is a bit possibly a schoolboy error. Or maybe I just like to keep him on his toes.
I've been scrolling through Muckrack trying to find, like, I'm trying to guess which one it is. And
it's the one
about the World Cup.
No, it's about how the tax raise on gambling in the UK is a shit idea.
The Reeves tax raids are no longer working. That one?
Yeah, I think so. Rings a bell. I read it before I moved house, Fintan.
Sorry.
I told you, I'm a big picture guy. I'm not a details guy. Matthew, my first question, this is going to sound like a really odd question.
Fire away.
Are you any relation to Jonathan Lynn?
No.
Okay.
It's quite a common name, actually, but a great series. If you're talking about the guy who wrote Yes, Minister, then fantastic series. Wish I was, but unfortunately not. No.
It is quite a common name, but more frequently in my experience with an E on the end, you're L-Y-N-N.
Yeah.
And so I just thought I'd ask. He was also the director, arguably more famously for our American listeners, of the Oscar-winning movie My Cousin Vinny.
Very good.
Marisa Tomei won her Oscar. What a wonderful career the guy had. I mean, just, exceptional. So we've established that you're nobody. No, I'm just kidding.
Thanks.
That's okay. No, but so you write a column for the Telegraph
That's correct.
in Britain. What's it, does your column do you specialize in political columns generally?
It's an economics business, some politics.
Okay.
So,
Yeah, difficult to untangle those three.
fundamentally the economy, but from a political angle.
How long, what were you doing before that? What's your like path as a journalist?
I've been a journalist for a long time. Started at the Sunday Times, worked there for about 10 years, wrote a column for Bloomberg, probably about 10 years as well. And I've been doing the Telegraph column, gosh, quite a while actually, probably about 15 years, something like that. So,
Hang on, right. You started at the Times.
I didn't quite start at the Times actually. I started on a trade magazine for a year or two, but then I moved to the Sunday Times.
I've got to ask you, what was the trade magazine?
Financial advisor.
Fintan, do you know it?
I think it's still around, right?
I'm not sure it's still around. It was a while ago.
It's a while ago.
Anyway.
Was that dealing in old money as well? I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
But I get the piss ripped out of me all the time because I'm most of the journalists in the gambling industry, most of the B2B journalists are a lot younger than me.
Yeah.
Curse them with their energy and their hair. So, but I mean, that is quite a career path. I mean, the Times being your first sort of newspaper gig, that's, you must be pretty decent at what you do.
Well, I don't know. I see. I've managed to stay employed for a while, so if that's the benchmark, I guess I'm okay. Yeah,
Honestly, that is the benchmark.
I think that is the benchmark. If you find people to pay you, that's that's quite good going.
Which reminds me, sponsorships are available across our three podcasts. We always like to get that in at some point in the episode. So Matthew, yeah, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, would you mind explaining to Fenton what the column that I read and that I contacted you about was all about?
Yeah, I mean, I was picking up. I think this was a few weeks ago now. Just in the last budget, Rachel Reeves, who's a pretty terrible chancellor, in my view, one of the worst we've had for a long time. Even if you're coming at it from the left, anyway, she put up. I mean, I'm sure you guys have discussed this in the past, and your listeners probably know about it. She put up gambling duty quite significantly in the last budget. And it's clearly backfiring. I mean, she wants to kind of get the money somewhere, but we're seeing a lot of the traditional bookmakers closing down on the high street. We've seen people like William Hill saying they're going to have to close down. I think Pat had to look up the piece. It was a few weeks ago to get you the details, but I think Paddy Power, lots of the bookmakers on the high street are, cutting back their physical operations, and it's hard to see how that's a win. I mean, gambling's, as I'm sure you've talked about on this show, gambling's a major industry, and we can, everyone can have a debate about whether gambling's good or bad. Maybe there's too much gambling, maybe there isn't, but it's a major industry. It's a major British industry, and it's also a major industry on the high street. Go to any high street anywhere in Britain, you get to see a bookmakers, and the high street's not in great shape, is it? You walk down the high street, and a lot of the shops are closed, a lot of the restaurants are closed, a lot of the bars and cafes are closing, a lot of boarded up shops, a few charity shops. And the bookies wasn't the most attractive place on the high street. It was usually a couple of old geezers sitting inside with a cigarette, and you went inside, they got those funny little barrows. But it's not a good idea to close them down. The high street's already in lots of trouble. So my general argument was, you put up the tax, but the second round effects are damaging to the economy at all.
Which I think is pretty fair, as you say. We're just starting to see the activity from the affected businesses, and they're just starting to really feel what the future holds. And obviously, the next 8 to 12 months is going to be really interesting. But I mean, we're already seeing. Oh crap! Who's up for sale, Fintan? Is it Evoke?
Yeah, it's Evoke. Yeah. Evoke's put themselves up for sale. And I think they've already said they're going to part, they will get to close quite a lot of the shops in the UK.
But I mean, it's highly likely in that situation that the bricks and mortar estate will be separated from everything else they do.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not a gambling industry specialist. I'm not, you know, I'm not a huge specialist in the industry. Probably more, you know, my angle was more, and actually you see this, you know, you've seen this across a whole range of things that the government's done, that they put up taxes, and when you take the second round effects into account, they end up backfiring on them. So, I mean, I'm not a huge specialist in the gambling industry, but a very clear example of putting up taxes, and actually when you net it all out, you know, they might raise a little bit of extra money in the short term, but the long-term effects going to be quite damaging.
I think I was wondering whether, you know, you said about Rachel Reeves being a terrible chancellor, which we'll come back to in a second. But I'm wondering if, so I've attributed over the years an awful lot of social ills coming down to shitty short-term decision-making, because businesses make their decisions based on their quarterly reports rather than what might be good for all of mankind kind of thing. So people have this very short-term approach to the decisions they make in business. Now, I think it's fair to say any government needs two terms to really see what they're about. This Labour government is not going to get two terms, not a chance in hell. But that's kind of a shame, kind of a blessing. All they had to do was not be the Conservatives, and they even fucked that up. But anyway, they need any government needs two terms when they come in, because the first term is getting their feet under the table, correcting what they see as the previous incumbent's errors or whatever, and putting things through Parliament, and then enacting them. And it all takes. I mean, Parliament's glacial. Any government is glacial in its pace of change. I wonder if chancellors suffer from that same short-termism because they're thinking, oh, shit, we've got to definitely be here for a second term because otherwise we're going to be a complete failure and I will be a complete failure as chancellor or whatever. Do you think that's a thing for a chancellor? Do you think there's that short-termist approach? Because those raises in gambling duty, everybody in the industry said this is a shit idea because it's a short term, it's a very short term gain and the long term effect will be much greater. And actually experts outside the industry said the exact same thing. It won't be the bounce that you think it is. Do you think there's a degree of short termism for chancellors, not just Rachel Reeves, but do you think that's something that chancellors suffer from?
No, I don't think so. I think it's her. She's very bad at the job. I don't think it's inevitable. You go look back at, you know, look at previous chancellors. They managed to stick around for a while and do quite long term things. I mean, take Gordon Brown. He was chancellor for was it 10 years or 11 years? I'd have to check exactly, but a long time. In my view, actually, I think he was a very poor chancellor. And we get into that in a separate discussion. But he made big decisions. And he made big decisions quite early on, actually. In his first week, he made quite big, dramatic decisions, like making the Bank of England independent, which had, you know, long-term consequences. You know, if you think back further, you know, Nigel Lawson, Mrs. Thatcher's main chancellor, you know, in my view, an excellent chancellor. He was around for a long time, made big decisions in his first year. Geoffrey Howe, before that, made some big major decisions in his first year. Even George Osborne, controversial character as a chancellor. Not many people speak up for George anymore. I thought he did some good things. But he was chancellor for, I think, 6 years. If he hadn't lost a referendum, he probably would have stuck around for 8 or 9 years. And he made quite big decisions about resetting and rebalancing the public finances. In his first few months in office, some people liked them, some people hated them. You know, we could debate that another time. So it's perfectly possible, certainly when you come into office with a big majority, as this Labour government did, it's perfectly possible to make some big decisions, to make some big calls. You have the authority, you have the power. And, you know, you have within 2 or 3 years, you won't see results right away. But certainly by the time the next election comes around, which will be 5 years away, you'll start getting some results out of it. But, you know, Rachel Reeves came in. She had absolutely no idea what to do. She was totally unprepared. And she made a series of short-term decisions. So the gambling tax is just one example. There's actually plenty of examples. There are bigger and much worse examples, actually. I mean, it's one of the relatively minor ones that she's made. But it,
Brendan,
you know,
what are the other ones?
Oh, well, there were two huge, there were two big decisions she made on taking office, one of which was to have a very big, a very significant increase in public sector borrowing, push that up by about £70 billion. We're seeing that now, the impact in the rising of gilt yields. You try and go out and get a mortgage, it's costing you a lot more. That's a direct result of her decision to push up borrowing. You know, way beyond, even when the public finances were already in relatively poor shape. And secondly, she put up taxes very significantly, not just very significantly, but in the worst possible way. There's a general consensus amongst economists that if you're going to put up tax, the very worst way you can do it is employers' national insurance, because it's a tax on jobs. And, you know, you kind to have a functioning economy, you kind of need a few jobs. you know, and there are better taxes and there are worse taxes. It was a very, very bad way to increase taxes. And then you saw that coming through with the consequences of that. You saw companies cutting back on employment. You saw a big drop in vacancies. And now you're seeing, you know, companies close down because you have to pay the national insurance. It's not corporations tax. It's not a profit on tax on your profits. You have to pay it regardless of whether you're making any profits or not. So at the margin, you know, there's some companies, particularly retailers, already struggling. A lot of cafes and restaurants already struggling. They can't operate without staff. You put up the tax on each member of staff and you look at the books and you think this doesn't function anymore. And companies have to close down. So she made those kind of decisions and they backfired on her. So, you know, she's a remarkably poor chancellor. It's not inherent in the job. You know, somebody who was cleverer or more political or had a better understanding of how the economy worked. Even I think coming from a left-wing perspective, you know, obviously she's, you know, a left-wing politician, but even coming from that perspective, I think you could have done a far better job. And the gambling tax is just one minor example. As you say, everyone in the industry, it was pretty obvious to everyone that was a bad idea, was going to have negative consequences. But she went ahead and did it anyway.
Yeah, because the gambling industry is the easy puppy to kick.
I guess that's true. It's an easy target to hit. And you know, we can all have a debate about whether gambling is good or bad. You know, my personal view is it's fine in moderation. It's like alcohol, you know. It's like lots of things. It's fine if people in moderation. Some people get addicted to it and go over the top, and that's obviously quite damaging. But this tax wasn't really about controlling, you know, gambling addiction or anything like that. I think it was just. So you just thought, oh, there's an easy target. We can get, you know, 400-500 million extra a year, and we can use that to just keep the books ticking over for a little while. And she didn't stop and think, you know, what's the impact going to be on the actual industry?
Yeah, you might get that 400-500 million for the first year.
Yeah, you might not even, when the figures come in, you might not even get that. You know, I mean, quite a lot of the taxes that she's put up, you know, you get the first year figures. And they don't come in. You know, we saw it. I mean, there's so many examples. We saw it on the VAT on school fees. You know, they didn't expect schools to close down. It turned out the Scottish government has started calculating the figures. You know, it's costing them more money. So you don't even get the money in the first year. If enough gambling, you know, if people like William Hill closed down all their shops on the high street, you know, think of, you know, what's each shop got? You know, 3-4 staff. So those jobs are lost. You lose the national insurance, you lose the income tax that they're paying, you lose the business rates on the shop. The shop's almost certainly going to be empty. I can't see anyone wanting to take over those premises on the typical, you know, high street at the moment. You start netting out those effects. He doesn't even get the money in the first year. You know, a better chancellor would have seen that. You know, you come in as chancellor, the Treasury puts a whole list of tax. Treasury officials, they just do their job. They put a whole list of potential tax rises on the desk, say, these are your options, Chancellor. She would have gone through them with a red pencil and said, no, that one's rubbish. You know, we can't do that. It's not going to work.
Is it unusual for a Chancellor?
Give me something better.
is it unusual for a chancellor to not be an economic expert? I mean, I'm assuming that you know that she's not an economic expert. I'm sure.
Well, she said she was an economic expert. She worked at the Bank of England.
Yeah, but the Bank of England uses all sorts of people, cleaners, copywriters.
She probably isn't an economic expert. Lots of chances aren't economic experts. You know, they don't have to be an economist. There's a good argument that the best chancellors aren't actually economists. They bring a bit of common sense to the world.
Yeah, I guess you need that balance between...
I mean, the Treasury is full of clever economists, and, you know, they can say to them when they look at the tax rises, well, what's the second round effect of that going to be? You know, what's going to happen if we put up this tax?
Yeah. It's one thing to just look at figures.
In her defense, she was an economist at the Bank of England.
She isn't an economist. Yeah, I mean that's not the problem. It's not this, the problem. Is not that she doesn't. The problem is that she does. It's not that she doesn't know the economics. She knows. She knows some economics. She knows as much as I do, and probably even more.
The problem
than
that
you.
She should know better.
I think there's a couple of points to kind of build on. So the shop closures would probably happen anyway, because a lot of the tax changes were aimed at the online gambling rather than the land based. Stuff. There's actually a bigger issue around the horse racing industry. So the UK gambling industry subsidizes the UK horse racing industry. And there was a carve out for horse racing to protect jobs and things like this. But if the gambling firms are, you know, spending more money on tax, there's less money for sponsorship, which then means that has a real trickle down effect to stable yards and the entire race economy in the UK. And I think there's going to be a lot of stuff over the next few years where horse racing sponsorship is just not as attractive as it used to be. And I think that's really where it's going to be in the countryside where you're really going to see the job losses and the actual economic impact. And, you know, a stable yard, okay, they probably don't pay that well.
You know my thoughts on this.
I do know you've got strong thoughts on this, but they are, you know, they're also buying feed. They're, you know, there's mechanics. There's like everybody, all the service economy around a stable yard, keeping that machine running. But my question around being a finance minister in the UK or a chancellor is, one of the things I noticed was they seem to be constantly testing ideas in the media. So in the run up to the first budget, there was constant, what felt like daily leaks of various ideas to test the water. And so I couldn't tell if it was just, they were so indecisive that it's just like, okay, let's see if this one works. Or was it, we know this is going to be a bad budget. So if all the leaks are really bad, then the budget's going to seem like a relief in comparison to what it could have been. Where what's your view on that?
Yeah, I mean, it was good fun if you're a journalist kind of covering this kind of stuff, because you could write a piece every day about whatever that day's leak was and why it was a terrible idea. So it kept a few people gainfully employed. It's got that to be said for it. No, I mean, I agree. It was a kind of psychodrama. I think it was. You know, I mean, she's actually an exceptionally poor chancellor by any historical standards, because that's unusual. You don't normally see that. In fact, the traditional thing with budgets, quite sensibly, was if you're going to put up a tax, you didn't tell anyone about it in advance, because then they start preparing for it and thinking, this tax is going to go up in November. I can start, you know, rearranging my affairs now to get around it. So normally you pull them as kind of a surprise. And that would be far better. I think two big problems. One, very indecisive, can't make up her mind how she should raise taxes. Two, lost control of her ministry. Because when people are leaking furiously, it usually means that the person who's meant to be in charge isn't really in charge. Nobody's really worrying too much about the person in charge. They're just kind of going off and doing their own thing. And, you know, a more decisive minister would clamp down on the leaks and say, who leaked that? Who gave that story to The Guardian? You're in big trouble.
So the leaks weren't deliberate. It was just bad management.
I don't think that you can kind of dress it up as some kind of clever strategy. I mean, it's not clever, you know. I mean, it's not clever because it backfired. I mean, they leaked lots of stuff. You know, they leaked lots of stuff on capital gains tax that they were going to put it up, but then they didn't, and then people sold their companies and moved to Dubai.
There was people canceling their pensions.
Yeah, absolutely. On the pensions one, they leaked that they were going to raid pensions, and then people cancelled their pensions or they emptied out their pensions ahead of it, and then they didn't do it. You know? I mean, it's just stupid. I mean, that's just a really bad way to do it. If you're going to change the tax on pensions, which is a pretty big thing to do, you know, prepare it in advance and tell people on the day and pass legislation, and that's done. And there's nothing you can do about it to avoid it. But leaking it, you know, what was clever about leaking it? Getting a bunch of people to cash in their pensions, and then not even making, you know, introducing the tax. It's not clever. It's just incompetent.
It's fairly damning. Is that, can I ask, I don't even know if this is an appropriate question, but is your political leaning a big part of this opinion, or are you saying this as objectively as you possibly can? And I'm making assumptions about your political leaning.
Well, I didn't vote Labour. No, I mean, I'm generally a free market libertarian conservative. I believe in, you know, small government and low taxes. So obviously, I'm, you know, not sympathetic to the position that the current government is coming from. Yeah, I mean, that's you know, I'm not making any secret about that. So that's where the critique is coming from. But I would add to that that even if you're coming, you know, from a more left-wing socialist perspective, you know, it's a remarkably inept and hopeless government. I think, you know, there are a lot of things, you know, they could be doing from a more, you know, from a more left-wing point of view, which in my view would ultimately fail because, you know, that's my kind of ideological grounding, but would make a much better fist of it than this current lot are. You compare it, say, you know, you compare it to President Macron in France, who came out of a socialist government and went in a more centrist direction, but it's fundamentally, you know, a kind of left-wing socialist administration, did quite a lot in his first term. Ultimately, he's a failure and France is in a mess. But he did quite a lot to kind of juice things up and to promote growth and to get France moving and to, you know, get new businesses and industries going. And we haven't seen anything like that from the Starmer government in the UK.
France has a very healthy casino industry.
Yeah, no, it does. I mean, France has some good things going for it. I mean, you know, it's still actually, at the end of the day, it has lower growth than we do and even worse debts. But that's a different story. I mean, we'd be here all day if we talked about every country in the world. But my general point was, you know, if you compare her to Macron, you know, he did far better. Coming from a, you know, a generally similar kind of political starting point, you know, kind of centrist, centre-left.
I do believe that any country that builds its day around a big meal and a nap is doing something very, very right. it's interesting because any argument at the moment of any kind quickly becomes bipolar, generally. And people are vehemently one side, vehemently the other, and they find their tribe and they all shout in unison. And this is pro things and anti things, pro gambling, anti gambling, etc. But politically, huge, huge thing. But what's really interesting in this country, in Britain at the moment, is that you see people arguing online and they're having these theoretically right-wing, left-wing arguments. And they're not actually right-wing, left-wing arguments at all. But that's their footing. That's where they feel safe. And what's really fascinating is that even in those arguments, nobody is standing up for the incumbent government. It's like nobody thinks they're doing a good job. I have not seen anybody stand up for the present government in an argument in, God, months and months and months. It's like across the board, everybody's like, yeah, they're doing a shit job. So let's talk about something else. This might be a daft question, but what would you have done differently to what Rachel Reeves did? As somebody who looks at business and economics and politics, what could she have done? And what, or even if it's, whether it's to the gambling industry or elsewhere, what could have been done that wouldn't have been such a shit show?
Oh, wow. I mean, you know, that's a big question. It would take us a long time to sort that out. I mean, the first thing she could have done, the first thing they could have done is actually kept Jeremy Hunt as Chancellor. He was doing okay. You know, growth was coming back a little bit. Investment was starting to go up again. The spending was being kept under control. And, you know, taxes were coming down a little bit. If you're coming at it for, I mean, what's your question? If you're coming at it as a Labour chancellor rather than a Conservative chancellor, what would, I mean, there are plenty of things you could do as a Labour chancellor. It was very disappointing that they did so little. So I think, you know, you could have certainly reformed the planning system. You know, one of the big problems that pretty much everyone agrees is a problem in Britain is that we don't build enough and everything we build is too expensive. They did, you know, so they could have dramatically cut the number, you know, it's, when you say cut the regulations, people kind of get scared, but you could have simplified the regulations. So it was much easier to build things so that you lowered the costs. They could have done something about electricity prices. Industrial electricity prices are catastrophic in the UK, four times the United States, twice the level of France. You know, which is not a cheap country, but you know, a huge swathe of industry being closed down. Most of the petrochemicals industry, you see things, you know, basic materials like cement production has gone back down to 1950s levels. You know, you can't really run an, you know, if you get the weeds of it, you can't run a successful economy without any cement. You know, it's very fundamental because you've got to build stuff. You know, there's not many forms of economic enterprise that don't involve a building somewhere along the way, like it's a warehouse or a shop or a house. If you can't build any because there's no cement and it's too expensive to make, then there's no point in being too surprised when you get zero growth. So they, you know, they could have started tackling issues like that, but they just showed no interest.
Okay. It's a great answer. It's a really damning answer, but it's a really solid one. You spend time in the States and you write also for an American publication. Now, looking, I don't know, I'm not sure what your handle would be on this, whether you paid any attention to this at all, I don't know. But what's going on in the States in gambling is quite interesting and quite unique, in that you have regulated sports books in, what is it, Fintan, about 23 states?
More, I think.
But it's not shit. It's not all of them.
It's not all, like, it's not California and Texas, but it's pretty much everywhere else.
Or Utah. We can safely rule Utah out for the foreseeable future. Hawaii as well. Alaska as well. So that's at least five. But yeah, so we've seen a sports book sort of explosion, which to the rest of the world looks bonkers because we've all had bookies for centuries and bookies haven't really been a big issue. But this sudden proliferation and smartphones and all of this jazz. But now the big thing is prediction markets. Now, the whole prediction market thing is, I know Fenton's definitely going to have an opinion on the whole prediction markets thing, but their argument is it's a contract, it's not betting, it's not gambling, it's not blah, blah, blah. Is this, are you aware of this whole situation?
Yeah. Prediction markets are very interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of, if looking from the outside, it just looks like the Wild West again in the US, you know. There's been a lot of pushback about sports books and about the proliferation of gambling advertising and all of that. But with the prediction markets coming under the CFTC, which is federal, right? And most gambling is on a state by state basis. It's like people in gambling sort of push back against the idea of there being any federal oversight in gambling. Personally, I think it's exactly what the American industry needs. It needs a framework and it needs consistency over certain fundamentals in gambling, whether that's player protection or taxation or whatever. It needs some sort of consistency. And states can govern under, you know, almost like an EU framework type thing. Well, like a federal framework, you might say. But there's always pushback against federal laws. But in the case of prediction markets, everybody seems to be saying, yeah, they're overseen by the feds. It's absolutely fine. Because what? I mean, why is that seen as a positive thing for prediction markets, but it would be generally federal oversight is seen as a negative thing by most Americans, particularly, I think I'm right in saying this, but particularly it's a Republican thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've got to be honest, I'm not a huge expert on American gambling law.
It's okay, so I'm after your opinion. We're good.
I'm not. Well, even to have an opinion on it, but I think you're right. I mean, I think a lot of the prediction. I mean, some of the prediction markets is quite novel. So it's quite interesting the way you can, you know, take a position on, you know, what's going to be the best AI model by the end of the month, or, you know, which company is going to produce these kind of results, or who's going to win the odds. There's a lot of stuff that's not traditional gambling, but I mean, a huge amount of the volume is basically sports betting. You can see that, you know, see that in the data, and it's kind of, I know a lot of people argue that it was kind of a backdoor way of legalizing sports betting, which was semi-legal, that had a lot of regulation around it in the US. So I guess, you know, I guess my take on it would be, insofar as it's sports betting, which is heavily regulated, they probably need to sort out their regulations and decide how they're going to regulate it, or whether they just want to allow the prediction markets to fundamentally deregulate it.
Yeah, and that's the tricky one, because those licensed, regulated businesses, they're paying through the nose to be there. It's not a high-margin industry. People are like, oh, look at all the money they're making. Honestly, there's not many that are making money. It's a very low-margin industry. Stop me if I'm wrong, Fintan. But it's an industry that relies on volume. And that volume is being cannibalized by an unregulated, differently taxed entity or entities.
Well, all right, so there's a couple of bits and pieces, right? So FanDuel and DraftKings themselves are number one and two because of a loophole, right? So they use the daily fantasy sports legislation.
This is why they're so cross, I think.
For sure, like, the game recognizes game, I think is probably the best way to describe it. They've seen this playbook and it doesn't end well for them, right? So they obviously, you know, grew massive databases off the back of DFS, and, you know, at one point were outspending all of the alcohol companies on TV ads during the NFL and these kind of things. There's that. One of the big advantages that the prediction markets have is, apart from being able to take customers from California and Texas, they can also take people who are 18 or over rather than 21 or older, which opens up a huge, and like we've had guests on talking about like the size of the amount of gamblers on, you know, college campuses and how prevalent and completely normal gambling is in a college kind of setting. So there's huge differences there. What's really interesting in terms of, now I can't remember the exact details, but I read this really great report in the FT a while ago where they broke down the economic model on how the prediction markets get paid, and they make significantly more money from sports betting than they do from what's the next AI, who's the next president, will Jesus return, just based on, because there's like a fee for market. Anyway, a lot of these things, there's a lot of transactions just at the end, where the beauty of sports betting is there's a lot of transactions throughout the entire market period. And that ends, so basically sports betting is completely funding everything else that these guys are doing. So there's a bunch of stuff going on there where I think they've actually got a massive advantage over the regular sports books.
And they've also just tapped into like my 14-year-old's quoting, Polymarket things to me. I think they've just tapped into what the younger generation wants. And it's not your dad's sports book. It's these markets.
Well, that's all the more reason for regulation to catch up.
Oh, 100%. But we've seen this game. Like it takes, tech, any major tech change will massively outpace legislation. Like look at the gambling industry. Like we've got the notion of a gray market. A market where there is no legislation to say this is allowed or not allowed. That was the backbone of the British gambling industry online for years. And, still is a little bit if you squint.
But the problem for the states that's different is two things, two big issues. One is this is going to come down to federal versus state. And that's a in any instance where this comes up, actually no, it comes up, it's a three-way fight, federal, state, or sovereign, because the tribes are in this as well. And that's a huge problem, and you might actually end up seeing lines redrawn as a result of this argument. The difference that the tribes make in this argument is that they arguably have more money than any other group to put into this and to fight it. The tribes may actually decide how this turns out. And they will pour money into it. They know how big this is. But the other thing is, and something that we've said on this podcast is, the thing that is unique to the United States is how massive college sports is. Amateur sports is bigger in the US than pro sports is in most other countries. And that's a unique vulnerability. It's a unique vulnerability that hasn't been thought about in legalization of sports books. It hasn't. I know you're looking at me puzzled and we're not recording video.
Okay, but is it has been like there
It's been
is
thought
states
about as
where
in you can bet on it.
or not bet on it.
Yeah, or not bet on it, but mostly you can bet on it. But the point is that you've got some incredibly vulnerable young people playing these sports. You've got very vulnerable young people who are trying to live normal lives, get a degree, do all of that shit, who are getting threats, abuse, violence. And they didn't think that shit through. Because on your average college basketball court, you haven't got security, you haven't got stadium
Or you're
security.
not getting paid, right? Or I know it's a little bit different now with the sponsorship, but
But
like,
it is a it's a completely unique facet to sports betting. It's completely unique to the United States. And it needed much more thinking through. Because you've got vulnerable young people right in the heart of it, and that seems a little fucked up to me, gotta be honest with you. It's like, think of the children. Yeah, I'm thinking about betting on those fuckers. So yeah, I think the US has these, just the inclusion of the tribes, that completely, yes, it's federal versus state, but it's also, look at these accords that we have, look at the agreement that we have about gambling. You're breaching all of that. This is gonna, like, if this was starting from a standing position, sports books are legal, CTFC governed prediction markets comes in, you're still talking about probably 3 years before any regulation arrives, right? Throw the tribes in, this is 15 years away, 15 years in court. It's going to be messy. It's going to be really, really messy. And my money, were I to bet on such a thing, and I hope that there is a prediction market for it, my money is going to be on the tribes.
No, really?
Yep, 100%. They are going to go into this aggressively. They're going to go into it fully funded, and they've got more money than any other party that's involved in the conversation.
Okay, yeah, I
They
could see
wanted to,
that.
they could buy FanDuel. If they wanted to, they could buy DraftKings. If they wanted to, they could buy any of the prediction market companies, if they wanted to. Just saying.
That's interesting. That's a really interesting concept.
I've been wrong before, though.
No, but it's not about being right or wrong. It's like, what's the direction of the trend, right? But yeah, it just ties up. Like, again, the only winners, the lawyers.
In fact, if I were going to be betting on my prediction markets, I'd be betting that there's going to be a big rise in Range Rovers ordered in California with the heated seats, heated and cooled seats, on the back of this. Yeah. In your writing for the Washington Post, Matthew, what is interesting that's going on in the US? You got anything juicy for us?
The president is always creating lots of news. The one thing about American politics is it makes even British politics look quite tame and polite by comparison. Obviously there's lots of stuff going on in the US. The president, the war is very unpopular.
Unpopular both sides?
I think it's unpopular on both sides, yes. Yes, it's popular with almost no one else. Unpopular with the Democrats, very unpopular with his MAGA base. J.D. Vance was saying before he became president, would defend him and say, well, the one good thing about a Trump presidency is at least he won't start any wars in the Middle East. His base is not interested in foreign wars, is quite isolationist. They don't particularly want to get involved in overseas conflicts, so he's probably shredded his base. He's going to lose the midterms very badly. I mean, basically, he'll be a lame duck after the midterms in the autumn. He's done some major things in his first year and a half. The tariffs are quite significant. He's cut back on immigration, particularly illegal immigration. Very successfully, actually. You can argue about whether you should cut back. Everyone can take a different view on whether you should cut back on illegal immigration or whether you shouldn't. But the fact is that he's cut it back from very high levels. One of the things about illegal immigration is we tend not to know exactly what it is because it's a clue in the world of legal. they don't sort of turn up and register on day one, but there was certainly lots of evidence that it was very high. But they've cut that back to pretty much zero, which is very significant for the United States. And again, you can argue about the rights and wrongs of that, but that's a big change. And there was a certain amount of unpleasantness involved, obviously, with the ICE forces. They kind of brought that under control. A lot of it was very performative. It was actually about deterring people from attempting to enter the United States illegally. So I think that was a big change. And certainly on his own terms, quite successful. It's actually interesting in a British context. It's 2,000-mile United States border. They managed to secure it. A land border. We can't secure a sea border, which is much shorter. As you scratch your head, say, what can you actually do? Actually, you can do stuff if you want to. Although it might have a little, it might be a little bit unpleasant for a few weeks. So he's done some interesting stuff. He's had some achievements, but he's basically a lame duck. The war probably destroyed his presidency. He's going to lose control of the House, be a lame duck, may well be impeached, because that's the kind of thing the Democrats do. It'll be a big legal argument, and then he'll be replaced by a different president in 2 years' time. American politics is always exciting.
I have a theory about how this is going to go down, right? Now, the war, there is no obvious or easy resolution to their position. There's no simple way out at all without losing face or making concessions or whatever. And they won't get back to the position that they started with, which is, the Straits of Hormuz being open, etc. And I think they've severely underestimated the Iranian stubbornness. I think they expected capitulation. They shouted about capitulation and Iran did anything but capitulate. In fact, they did the opposite. But my take on this is that if that goes the way that you say, if we get to the lame duck part, if we get to losing the house, which all of this is very possible because he did the one thing that an American president should never do, and that's mess with petrol prices. Directly mess with petrol prices. What I think you'll see is, as possibly slightly ahead of any predicted impeachment, you'll see a declaration of a massive decline in cognitive ability and mental health. And I think you'll see a president that won't be prosecuted for anything on the grounds of some form of dementia, something along those lines. I've got a feeling that that's exactly the way it's going to go. I think it will be almost theatrical in the way that it's, you know what I mean? The last act will be escaping any action for any choices that were made, regardless of who made them. But right. Matthew, thank you for joining us. I'm sorry that you are not related to Jonathan Lynn.
It's a shame. I wish I'd written Yes Minister. I would be. What a fantastic show that was.
And still,
the more chaotic the government gets, yes. I love the little memes you get on social media where they have something very courageous minister. They're great, aren't they?
but Matthew, thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. If you don't mind, we might ask you back at some point. You are very welcome to say no. It's fine.
Yeah.
I'll do that. Right. Yes. Thank you, Matthew. Much appreciated.
Brilliant. Thank you, Matthew.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just at Gambling Files. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.